Hey, Yom Kippur.
Very good. Very good, Tony. And yours?
Yeah, it was good. I've been getting down the science of drinking a lot of Coca-Cola the night before, so don't really have too much coffee issues. I only have 2 cups a day, but I see other people, they get headaches and this and that, so a couple of years ago I started having like a good amount of Coke, like 2 large glasses, and either I'm psyching myself out or it's actually working, I don't know. Either way, I was fine.
Did that not keep you awake the night before?
No, not at all.
Oh. I have a high sensitivity to caffeine, and I suspect that if I did that, I wouldn't sleep for a long time.
So, yeah, it was, didn't you really affect it? I don't think I've ever had a problem, even if I have coffee in the evening. The only thing which affects me sleeping at night is if I take a nap in the afternoon, like on Shabbos. Then it's hard, then it's hard to get to sleep before like 1:30 in the night, 2 o'clock, something like that. All right, so, as we were talking last time, we were discussing Proverbs. I kept on calling it 1:18, it's really 10:18, so thanks for the correction on that. And just to review, also, if there's any questions that you have, I don't know if I'm over the holiday or whatever, you know, let me know. Is there anything else you want?
Oh, yeah. Why did you mention that?
Yeah, why? What's up?
No, I was thinking about the Modern Prayer in the morning when you first get up.
Right.
And it talks about returning my soul within me.
Right.
Any explanation for what happens to the soul during sleep?
Well, I think simply you're unconscious, and that's a state where if a person remains that way, you could say that the soul is not in the person. I mean, certainly if you go ahead and you wake up a person who's sleeping at 3:30 in the morning, their soul is in them. I mean, the fact that you're dreaming and that you have thoughts, your soul is in you. So your soul is not, I mean, the truth is, the soul is not inside your body, of course. It's not a physical thing, but it's as Rav Chaim put it, it's functionally related to the body. So there is no, you know, returning of the soul. It's just whether the connection exists. And certainly the connection is there even when you're sleeping.
Is there any reference to when people talk about the aura that they can see around the body? Is there any connection between that and the soul?
I've never seen an aura. I don't even know what an aura looks like, to tell you the truth, so. Let alone seeing it around the body, it doesn't make any sense. Something which is imagined, called an aura, it certainly won't have any physical characteristics. Nothing that's an imagination has a characteristic. I'm not even giving it the status of being real, because it's not.
Okay.
I have a completely different question.
Go ahead.
So, we read last week in Rosh Hashanah, in 16b, I believe, and it very clearly states that God judges the entire world. And that's always been my understanding.
Right.
But when I read about Yom Kippur, and I read Maimonides on Tshuva, it's not clear to me whether Yom Kippur applies to all of mankind. It appears to be a day of atonement for Israel. And I'm wondering if it's clearly understood or accepted or whatever that day of atonement applies to all of mankind, or is it just a day of atonement for Israel and the people of Israel and not necessarily for the rest of the world?
Well, it's interesting that you mention that, because I was, did you see the Jewish Times for Yom Kippur?
I saw it, but I have not read it all.
Okay, the article that I wrote goes into this a bit, and it talks about how my understanding is that Yom Kippur is actually a day that evolved. There was an evolution to it. The Ran, who's one of the Rishonim, you know, one of the authorities in the Talmud, he comments on the back of the Talmud, and he says that Adam was created on the first of the year. That means that the world that was created 6 days later, when God created the world from nothingness, So that was on the 25th of the month of Elul, which is the month before Tishrei. We're in Tishrei now. So we're now, this is the 12th of Tishrei today. So the last month, which is Elul, so God created the world on the 25th of Elul. 6 days later, which is the sixth day of creation, is when he created Adam. Adam was created on day six. So that ends up to be the first of Tishrei, which is Rosh Hashanah. So it's, the Ron says over there that God created man, brought him into the garden, and within an hour he sinned and he was judged and he was acquitted. So there was no Yom Kippur for Adam. He was judged and acquitted all in that one day of Rosh Hashanah. Now what happened was, at the time of the golden calf, you know, a few thousand years later, 2,500 years later, so the Jews sinned, and Moses went up to the mount, to Mount Sinai, for either, I think it was the second stay of 40 days and 40 nights, and he finally, on the 40th day, God was appeased and acquitted the Jews, and that was the 10th of this month, which is comes out to be Yom Kippur. So that seems to be where the significance of Yom Kippur comes from, is that the inceptional event was God's act of forgiveness for the Jews for the gold calf sin. But you didn't have any of the sacrifices, and that was, you know, clearly for the Jews. Adam, however, was not Jewish. So you see that the concept of judging and acquitting was all done on one day for Adam. So the concepts are there. They apply equally, you know, to whether a person is Jewish or not. The question is, what elements were dated, you know, were enacted on what day? The judging was, and acquitting all on one day? Was it, now we have with the judging, I mean, for example, even now, Maimonides says, and I think that the Ron also says, that a person who is totally righteous is judged, and we call, you know, have you read in the prayers, it talks about being written on Rosh Hashanah and sealed in Yom Kippur. Have you read that?
If so, yes.
Right. So that means that God gives a chance of 10 days for a person before the book is sealed on Yom Kippur. However, the Ron and Maimonides says, and Maimonides says that a person is totally righteous is written and sealed on Rosh Hashanah itself, because since he's totally righteous, there's nothing necessary for him to do for the next 10 days. The truth is, a righteous person is living properly, you know, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is not even, it doesn't really faze him, it doesn't affect him, because his mindset is always assessing his actions and repenting and you know, acting properly. So you see that even today, the concept of Yom Kippur doesn't even apply. I mean, of course, a Jew has to follow the laws, but the rabbis say that a person is totally righteous, there's nothing that God has to deliberate for the next 10 days. So you see that even now, it's something which is done all at once. A person is completely righteous. So I don't see why that should be any different for a person, you know, Jewish, not Jewish. But and then the sacrifices on Yom Kippur itself, that even came from a later event. I mean, it's very interesting that God had forgiven the Jews, and according to Sforno, what the sin was in terms of creating the gold calf was a need for some sort of a, you know, physical expression. So what God did, he made a concession to man, and that's when temple was allowed to be created. Temple wasn't going to be something that's part of the Torah system at all. It was only, according to Sforno, due to the need of the people to have some sort of a physical expression, that God allowed them to have a temple, which would then take those emotions but regulate them, as opposed to just letting them have free expression and making golden calves. So the temple came on the heels of that sin as a concession to regulate man's emotions and direct him properly to God and give him correct concepts. Now, once you had temple, so then Aaron's two sons on one occasion decided they're going to bring a sacrifice of their own decision. And because of that, they were killed. And on the heels of that, the Torah says that God tells Aaron, don't come into the temple at all times, you know, suggesting that so you don't die like your sons, because your sons just got killed because they tried to worship me with their own ideas, and that's wrong, that's corrupt. Just like you have to have the right concept of God, you must have the right concept about how you approach God. So since they came with a fire, the Torah says it was not commanded, and the Torah calls it a strange fire, an Esh Zorah, like a Voda Zorah. Zorah means strange. an alien type of worship. So it doesn't matter that they were doing it in the temple. They were killed. So then God tells Aaron afterwards, don't do like your sons. Don't come into the temple at all times. Only come, of course, when you're called, in the right clothing, at the right time. And God says, what's the reason? Because in cloud I appear over the ark. And what's God saying? It's the very first two verses in Parshas Achrimos, which is Leviticus.
Don't. Can you repeat the statement? Don't come.
Don't come at all times. Before me, behind the curtain, you know, the Kodesh Kedushim, behind the Paroches.
Right.
You shouldn't do that because in cloud.
Let me read it to you exactly.
There we go. So God spoke to him. This is Leviticus 16:1. So God spoke to Moses, to Aaron, after the death of the two sons of Aaron, when they drew close before God and they were killed. And God said to Moses, speak to Aaron, your brother, that he shall not come at all times to the Kodesh, the Holy of Holies, that is behind the separating curtain, called the Paroches, which is facing the Kaporos. The Kaporos was the lid of the ark that had the two gold angelic figures. So you shouldn't come close, behind the curtain, to the... that you should be facing the ark's cover, which is on the ark, and you should not die. Why? Because in cloud I appear on the covering of the ark.
On its face, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. It seems very, very enigmatic.
Yeah.
It's truly a cloudy statement.
No argument there. Don't come all the time because I... What was the chapter number again?
That's 16, 1 and 2. Leviticus, 16, 1 and 2.
Grab a chumash really quick.
Good.
How many times have I read over that and never stopped on it?
Yep. Same here.
Get your brother Aaron and let him not enter the sanctuary that is beyond the partition, concealing the ark, so that he may not die, since I appear over the ark cover in a cloud. Is it, could it be that we know that a person cannot look upon God and live, and so since God appears over the ark cover in a cloud, is he telling Aaron, don't go in there because, you know, you won't survive?
Well, you can't look upon God. That's number one. he's saying that you shouldn't come at all times to the Holy of Holies, which is behind that separating curtain called the Paroches. In order that you don't die. That means there's something in that act of going in there that's going to cause you to be killed. And that's what the two sons of Aaron did.
They brought unauthorized fire. I mean, essentially, they did something that God hadn't commanded them to do.
Right. And they went into the Holy of Holies. So there's something.
Oh, you mean when they went in and did the unauthorized fire thing, they went into the Holy of Holies?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's my understanding of exactly what they did.
I just thought they presented unauthorized fire.
Right, they said that they brought it. It's the beginning of chapter 10. If you go back a few chapters, Leviticus 10, 1.
Yeah, because it just says they offered it before God.
Right.
Although I see the Rashbam holds it's from the Holy of Holies.
Yeah, Rashbam says that?
According to the notes on this Chumash.
If we have a support. Yeah, it makes sense that that's what it did. What it means is it went before God. Because that's what God's telling Aaron not to do. Why would he tell him not to do something that has nothing to do with his sons? It must be when he tells Aaron that you should not come at all times to the Holy of Holies. Right? You shouldn't die, because that's specifically what the sons of Aaron did.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So back to the question regarding what exactly is this thing about cloud, right?
Right.
You shouldn't go in there, because I appear in cloud. And you'll notice also that that's one of the sacrifices, one of the, acts of worship on Yom Kippur, is that the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, and this is only the one time of the year that he does this. He goes into the Holy of Holies. He just goes in there with incense and fire and causes a cloud to smoke up that room, and then he leaves. That's the worship. That's done on Yom Kippur. So you see cloud again. There's also cloud at Sinai when God spoke to the Jews. So you see a number of cases there's a cloud, and also there was a cloud that whenever God appeared in the temple, it was always in a cloud. It was a cloud that came down over the temple, the tabernacle. See, what's going on is that God is trying to show a concept. And that's what he told Moses. You can't know me while you're alive. So, the way he expresses this is by creating a cloud. And that's exactly... Hold on one second. Okay, one second.
Okay, sorry about that. Unexpected. There's the door. Now, the question was regarding the cloud. So we're saying that the cloud itself is something which God creates in order to teach the lesson that there's a veil. We cannot know what God is. And also we can't approach God with any of our own invented practices. That would be considered idolatry. And since the sons of Aaron had done that, they were killed. So when you try to approach God or you assume an incorrect idea regarding God, that's the worst mistake a person can make. Okay, so over here when God says, now if we look at the verse, it'll make sense. So God says to, we're back in the beginning of Achrimos, and God says that they, to Aaron, that he shouldn't come at all time to the Holy of Holies, because in cloud I appear, meaning to say that you shouldn't come of your own accord, because there is a, you can't decide when to come. There's a cloud between me and you. I always appear in a cloud. I have a nature that you cannot understand. So therefore, you cannot make a decision about when you're going to come in. You can only come in to the temple when it's prescribed and with the right clothing. That's why it says in the next verse, with this you should come, should Aaron come to the Kodesh, to the Holies. And now it starts talking about all the sacrifices that are brought on Yom Kippur. With a bull, and for a sin offering, and a ram for a totally consumed offering, and certain garments. So, what God is saying is that because now, and this is now a further development in the evolution of Yom Kippur, these are the sacrifices that actually brought Yom Kippur. That's where we get them from, this section of the Torah. And what happened was is that once, like we said before, God made a concession, and he allowed them to have the temple, only because they expressed the need to have some sort of physical worship. So God said, okay, that can be done as long as it's regulated. But now once that temple was allowed, what happened was, again, human emotions and drives thought, I'm going to be a little bit more religious. I'll create my own type of a worship. But that's not good. The Torah says clearly, don't add and don't subtract from the Torah. And if a person does that, you see that they could be liable to death. Right. So that's what happened here. Once the temple was given to man, so the two sons of Aaron had taken even that, and their approach to God they corrupted. So therefore, what we do is on Yom Kippur we bring these animals, and we have this service where we smoke up the Holy of Holies in order to demonstrate that we agree that we cannot approach God directly. There's a cloud between God and us, so to speak. It's just a metaphor, the cloud. And what the sons of Aaron do also is that they have to bring a separate sacrifice from the Jews, because the priests are the ones that have the greatest danger, because they're in the temple all the time. So they have the greatest danger of falling prey to the over-religious emotion, because they're the ones that are, so to speak, closest to God in the temple. So therefore, they had to bring their own sacrifice, their own sin offering on Yom Kippur. But it's all brought about in Yom Kippur, I believe, because that's really where temple came from. It came from that 10th day of the month of Tishrei, where God forgave the Jews for the gold calf sin, and then because of that, he gave them a temple. So that all came about because of that 10th day where God forgave. So therefore, when the temple itself has infractions, that should also be brought on that day. So therefore, these sacrifices then came, and they became part of an extended service of Yom Kippur. But you didn't have these sacrifices until the sons of Aaron sinned. There was nothing really to address yet. Because once God gave the temple, so that's it, so you follow the laws. But until you have an infraction in the worship of temple, you don't need to have an atonement for corrupt temple service. Right? So it's only once you have temple that, and then you have a corruption in its service expressed by Aaron's sons, then you need to have atonement for those corrupt services. So that's what these sacrifices are. But you see how it all comes on the same day, it's on Yom Kippur, because it all it germinated from that 10th day when God forgave the Jews on Sinai, which was
the 10th of Tishrei, and then he gave the temple because of that. So you see how it all goes back to that one point.
Yep.
So you see, it's an interesting thing. It's not necessarily that... I was talking to Rabbi Mann about it, and he found it interesting, but he found it a very bold move to say that you would have something which was not necessarily planned in the Torah, like a day of Yom Kippur, but then it evolved, because I was, you know, I was telling him all of this idea. But then I recalled to him the fact that Sforno says openly that the temple is really a concession. It wasn't really part of the original plan. And the truth is, when I was discussing with another friend over the holiday, I think it was over Yom Kippur, he said, yeah, of course, because you see all the different things that Maimonides talks about, that half the Torah pretty much is coming to counter a lot of things that the other nations did, that idolatrous cultures had invented. So you see, if that those nations never existed, you wouldn't have prohibitions. Don't be like the Canaanite people. If the Canaanites never lived, you couldn't have such a statement. So it ends up that the Torah is something which is addressing events that took place. And if there were different, but it could very well be that human nature did go through all possible permutations of corruption, and it was addressed in the Torah using those examples. Maybe you would have had, if they didn't do it, maybe you would have had laws anyway that addressed the tendencies in man, because you don't really need to have a law based on an event if the tendency is still there and the tendency is corrupt. But it could be that in God's wisdom, he decided that it was better that it comes as response. So the laws only come in once there's a demonstrated need by man. But it's a long answer to your question, Doug. But yeah, the concept of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, do they apply to the Jew, to Gentile? You know, what parts apply to each? So, the Yom Kippur itself, I would have to look into it, but you see that Adam had an acquittal even without a Yom Kippur. So the concepts are there. It could be that there's something which a Jew sins, and therefore, and Moses pleaded with God, and therefore God atoned the Jews on the 10th of Yom Kippur, so it's only applicable to the Jews, because they're the ones that actually sinned with the gold calf. Or you could say, no, there was also the mixed multitude that came out, and they were Gentiles. So, but this was now at the point that they were coming to receive the Torah, so that means they were all one nation. So whether it was Jew or whether it was Egyptian, you could argue that it was basically all Jew. It's had to actually define who was what at that point is difficult, because there really were people that were following, you know, Abraham's monotheism, and then there's everybody else. So that didn't stamp you as a certain you know, quote unquote religion. How God classifies it, I don't know. But the bottom line has to be that a person who's living properly is going to have favor from God, and a person who's not is not going to have favor from God. And it makes no difference. You know, you're born Gentile or Jew. Abraham proves that. You know, Abraham proved that. And Ruth, I mean, we see enough cases. And in terms of what the words were that you found in the prayer, we'd have to take a look and see. Because we did read on Yom Kippur, we read the story about the city of Nineveh, which was not Jewish, and God forgave them because they repented. So why are we reading about that on Yom Kippur, unless the idea of Yom Kippur, you know, relates to non-Jews as well? I think that would be a good proof that the very concept of forgiveness, you see that God employed all throughout time. It doesn't matter Jew or not.
That's a very good point.
Yeah. It's funny, we were talking also about the whole story. So Jonah ran away. He got onto a ship, but he wanted to escape. And he didn't want to deliver the prophecy of telling Nineveh to repent. So he was on the ship, and God created a great storm at sea. And people were asking around, what's going on? Everybody said, pray to your gods. Everybody had all different gods. And they asked Jonah whose God was his. So by the fact that they asked him whose God was his, they couldn't tell by his dress what type of person he was. So you see that somebody wanted to say, you see, you know, Jews back then, the greatest prophets, they didn't dress any different than anybody else. You know, in order, like, it's sort of like a smack in the face to the Jews today that use dress in order to try to embody who they are. So evidently, he was not identifiable. So that was one interesting point somebody made. Then I noticed that when they heard what he said, that my God is the God who created heaven and earth, so they were at great fear. All of a sudden, they respected his God. That's an amazing thing. Like, if they knew about his God, so why would they praying to their other gods? If they had this type of it's an interesting thing I never noticed before. So he told them, listen, you have to pick me up and throw me over, and then the storm will stop, and then your ship won't be broken in two, and you'll all live. So they did. They lifted him up, they threw him over, and they asked to be forgiven for what they were about to do, and the fish swallowed him and the whole story. But it seemed to me that they all did reflect. These people were people who reflected. It's interesting. These people reflected when they saw a big storm and they were praying to the gods. The people of Nineveh didn't seem to do that. They just sinned to such a point that God was going to wipe them out. That was the prophecy that he told Jonah to go there with. Yeah, but that seems to be, it seems to be a good proof. There is no you know, preferential treatment for a person born Jewish. A person lives properly, and you know, that's God's decision. Why he does it, we don't know. We don't know why he creates one person a Jew, one person a Gentile, but it's definitely not giving anybody any added plus. We were speaking to Rabbi Chait once about a person who, let's say, is born into, some faraway country, has no contact with Torah, with Judaism, with God. And he felt, Rabbi Chait, I believe he told me at that time, that every person gets an opportunity in their life to select living the proper life. Somehow, so it's, I mean, in terms of God's justice, it seems to be like he's saying that God wouldn't put a person here without that ability to actually use the soul that he gave him. But the truth is, is that look at Abraham. I mean, Abraham had no teacher, everybody was idolatrous. So he basically used his own mind to question things. So you see that it's even part of the very fabric of the mind, that there's a sense of what makes sense and what doesn't. That aspect that we have, that ability to the discerning element, everybody has that. So will a person follow his emotions and bury that deep down, or will he entertain what his mind is trying to bring forward? And that could very well be what Rabbi Chait was talking about. Innately, we all have that opportunity. So it's a matter of whether we use it or we just decide to follow our emotions. And even the pygmies in faraway countries, even people that are still backwards in Africa, they have intelligence. Everybody has that ability. And if Abraham was able to do that, being submerged in idolatry, so it could very well be that that's why God selected him as being a forerunner of the nation, because he shows par excellence that you can be in the worst state, and with your own intelligence, you can bring yourself to the best state. So you have no better proof than that. So he really ends up being the proof, and then he stood up for all the tests of God and showing a love for God more than for his own son. Just an amazing individual. All right, and he was a Gentile. No, that's it just shows you. I mean, he has a place higher than any Jew today. But that's not what we're going to discuss today, right? We're going to do something Mishlei, right?
Right. How do we get off on these tangents? By the way, Debbie Longo's joined us as well.
Debbie who?
Yes.
Debbie
right
Longo.
Here.
Hi, Debbie. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. We have beautiful weather in New York. I always love that. This time of the year is just really nice. It's a little bit too warm if you ask me. I think it's like over 80 already. I'm waiting for the nice 55. I want to see my breath when I go outside. That's the weather. But it's sunny, I take it.
Well, Sukkot is going to be a warm time, huh?
It looks like it's going to be warm. It's supposed to be in the 80s this week. I'm not sure what's going to happen past Tuesday. But,
we'll see. Whatever happens, happens.
If it gets too hot, you don't have to stay in the sukkah. All right. All right, so that's an interesting thing about Doc Ramos and how the holidays develop. All right, so let's go back now. And so we discussed last time, we were in 10:18 in Proverbs. And we're talking about the emotion of approval, the need for approval, social approval. And the verse we had read said that a person covers up his hatred for somebody, he has lying lips. And what we said that meant is that his inactivity is akin to corrupt activity, as if he's lying with his lips. It's no different whether you actually say a lie or if you don't say something when you should. But the reason why he's doing it, we said, is because he's looking for approval, acceptance. Interesting, he needs the acceptance even from the person that he hates. That's a real, it really shows you which emotion is stronger. That need for acceptance is more important to certain people than the person hates, and he won't want to express it. He doesn't want to lose the friend. He doesn't want to lose that acceptance, that value. But that's wrong. We don't look to others in order to assess our status, our value. That's something which is completely based on whether we're matching God's value system or not. And the second part of the verse we said, if a person does say words, but he doesn't do them properly, but he speaks slanderously about somebody, he's a fool. Again, the person who speaks slander is doing that because why did he have to, and it says mostly, he brings it out. He brings out slander. So we said it's very telling because a person could feel a certain way and keep it inside. But the fact that he has to say it, that means he's communicating it to somebody. Therefore, he needs somebody to hear what he has inside. And we said that's because he's looking to objectify his feelings. He feels a certain amount of insecurity that this is all in my own feelings. Therefore, if I bring it out into the open, it becomes a spoken word. Even that, a person feels that there's a certain power to it or it's a certain reality. Now it's in the world. My words are now out there. Now it became part of the world. It's not just my imagination anymore. But the spoken word is as if a tree standing out there in the middle of the field. It's real. It's a real thing now. But it's also primarily because of the need for approval from others that he has to say this and he has to get other people to agree. Yeah, that guy's a real jerk. So now it's not just me. It's other people say it too. So he's a fool because that's the critique on this person. Because he is now giving value to what other people say. That's his barometer for what is real. If people agree with me, then my belief is real. But that's a foolish thing. Something is real is based on whether or not it is real, whether it's a creation of God, whether it's the truth or not. Okay, so that's what we had said on 18. All right? Now, 19 is a new verse. We didn't take up 19. But it continues. And he says, in the multiplicity of words, when a person speaks a lot, the rov devarim, lo yechdal pasha, there will not cease to be sin. And pesha means where a person is like wantonly unbridled in terms of a sin. There's different verses, as we saw over Yom Kippur. There's a sin where a person is just, he's made a mistake. That's chait. He made a mistake. Then there's a sin where it is the avon. Avon means he's perverse. He became perverted in his way. And pasha, which is this word here, talks about the concept of a person just unbridled, just unrestrained in his act of sin. He just went with the force of the emotion. That's what pasha is. So if a person speaks a lot, he's going to end up in Pasha. So we have to understand, why does one beget the other? But the one who holds back his speech, he's a wise person. So that's the verse we're going to take now. Let's take the first one. What does it mean with abundance of speech, you cannot cease from sinning, or there will not be sin will not be held back. Lo yachdal.
Would that indicate that if you're one of those people that just has to constantly talk, sooner or later you're going to say something that is a slip or inappropriate because you're not controlling your speech. You're just sort of letting it out like a faucet.
That I would ask you, what about Aristotle or Einstein? Some of these people who gave lectures a lot and spoke a lot, that their whole life was communicating.
Well, that's a fair point.
They engage their brain before they engage their mouth.
Okay, so therefore it's not the engagement of the mouth which is necessarily going to cause the sin. Then. So we can't say it's just because you're speaking that you're going to sin, right? If that was the case, everybody who ever spoke would have to sin.
But that's what the verse says.
On the surface.
The verse doesn't say anything about engaging your mind.
That is true also. But we can't say that it means that anybody who talks is going to sin. Although it seems to be saying that on the surface, right? Berov devarim.
I wonder if the key is in the meaning of the word multiplicity.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, if the verse simply wanted to say, if you talk, you're going to make a mistake, it could say that, but when it uses the term multiplicity of words, it seems to be talking about a different concept, an idea that you it's like you're saying too much.
Okay. You want to elaborate, please?
Yeah, like rather than just try to get your idea across, perhaps there's another motivation under there, which is why you use a multiplicity of words.
Okay. So it's not just for communication.
Right. And I wonder if that relates back to 10:18, where you're trying to get something from the listener. Or you're trying to make some kind of impression. In other words, there's some emotional need in the speaker that the speaker is trying to fulfill.
Good, that's the answer. You just said the answer.
Okay.
Meaning that there's an emotional need, and that's what's producing speech. Meaning, speech could either be because of communication, which is fine. That's a kosher action, that's good. Or the sinful act is where a person vents. Speech is many times used just because a person has bottled up emotion. So when a person is, like you said, you keyed in properly, that was good. I didn't even see that until you brought it up. The multiplicity, when there's an abundance of words, meaning it's more than necessary to communicate, so therefore why are you speaking more? Because there's an emotional need. Speech is a venting valve for most people. So when you see somebody who speaks a lot, the reason they're doing that usually is because there's an emotion. And if it's an emotion that they're expressing, of course they're going to sin, because emotion is the opposite of rational speech. And there was actually an event in the Torah which the people were punished just because they spoke. Meaning, there were many times the Jews spoke and they said things, but they didn't always get the fiery serpents. But there was only one time in Jewish history that they got the fiery serpents. Why? Because there they were using their speech just as a mode of venting. There was really nothing that they were communicating. If they complained about not having water or not having something like that, so then that was warranted. They had to complain. They needed water. So they weren't punishment snakes for that. But there was one time where they grew tired on the way, it says, and then they spoke against God and against Moses, it says. And that is the one time God sent the serpents. Why? Because the serpent is a callback to that primordial snake in the Garden of Eden. So speech was used by that snake and to beguile the woman. So that became its basic logo. It became its identification. So snake always represents evil speech. And that's, I think, Rashi even says why Moses' staff had turned to a snake, to remind him that he said that the Jews are not going to believe. He said something negative about the Jews. And also when he put his hand in his chest and he took it out, and it was leprous also, because that's punishment for evil speech too. So the signs that God gave Moses were hinting to the fact that he said something which is really not warranted. Now, here it says, with a multiplicity of words, you will not cease from having sin. Because here, a person who speaks a lot is doing so because of the emotional outlet that he's trying to satisfy. And since what he's involved is an emotional outlet, so then of course he's going to sin. He's just going to express any emotions that he has, which is sinful. He's engaging it. And you should also keep in mind that speaking about something, like we said earlier, a person feels unconsciously that it satisfies the fact that now it's real. So it's almost like people a lot of times want to speak about something that they can't perform. So people are like very sexually driven will speak around, you know, they'll speak about it. That'll be on their tongue because that satisfies the drive somehow. Okay?
That makes sense.
Right, so it's perfect again. With an abundance of words, you will not cease from having sin. But the person holds back his lips, he's wise. Let's understand that now.
Well, would it be that the person who holds back his speech is weighing his words very carefully and...
You made a mistake. It says, well, maybe he didn't make a mistake, but I just want to be exact as possible here. It doesn't say a person holds back speech. It says it holds back lips. So if we're really going to get to the core idea, we have to recognize he changed the word just now.
Oh, okay. Thank you for correcting that.
But go ahead. You were going to say what? Let's just take it from your idea. If a person holds back his speech...
Well, I was going to say he's carefully weighing his words and choosing them to be most appropriate at the most appropriate time. So it's just the opposite of the first half. He would be someone who's looking at the situation and determining what's needed or necessary, but it wouldn't be driven by any personal emotional need.
Right.
Once upon a time, we defined wise as someone who sees and operates on the basis of consequences. So if we apply that here, the person who holds back his lips is carefully weighing the consequences of the words that he could speak and selecting the appropriate ones as needed.
Right. Just see. We want to make sure Chosen usually means darkness. You probably mean restrain over here. Let's take a look. Let's see.
Rabbi, I was wondering if perhaps in the term restrains, it's holding back, seems to me to indicate the desire to want to say it.
Yes.
It's holding back.
Yes, I agree. I agree with you.
Like pinching your lips shut. So wanting to say something, but stopping yourself by purposely holding your lips together.
Yes, I agree with you.
Even if it's right to speech or something that needs that isn't false, or maybe something that's not even emotional, sometimes there's still a time to remain silent, even
so what does that teach us?
Maybe in so, rational thought.
So a person
doesn't always need to be said.
Right. So a person who has nothing to say, so he's not doing an act of holding back. It's a person who has something to say, but he restrains himself. So that...
Correct.
Okay, so now we have to understand what the difference is between those two people. I agree with you 100%. That's very significant. The fact that you do want to say something, but then you hold back, now you're considered wise. So now, what went on in that person's mind? Why is that person wise?
Because they're weighing the consequences of what their words could do.
Okay, it's one possibility.
Perhaps it's also a learning experience. Like a teacher doesn't always need to say everything. It can also be for the other person to figure things out, to give that other person time to reflect.
You mean I'm holding my words back to give somebody else time to reflect?
Correct. Just as you teach for us, you pose questions, but you give us time to reflect. You don't burst out the answer.
But that would be me. That would be... I don't think we should bring another person into the equation here. It's talking about the person who is going to hold back, meaning in contrast to the first person who just, you know... has an abundance of words. We're talking about a person who now doesn't. He has something to say, but he holds back. So he's wise in and of himself. I wouldn't bring another person into the picture. There's no...
How many of us speak with no one else there? I mean, isn't the idea of speech communication between others?
No, it could just be I'm going to ridicule somebody, and I just need somebody to hear it, so I feel that it's really real. But now I hold myself back, and therefore, I'm called wise because I held myself back from slandering somebody. Because it has nothing to do with giving somebody else time to think about it. It could just be that I saw that it was wrong and I didn't do it. But evidently, when I hold back my speech, it means that I'm recognizing, like Doug was saying, I do recognize the wrong in the action. But why does it make me wise? Why should that make me wise? Just because I can hold myself back? Or is there something else going on that really displays wisdom?
Is it possible that the person also has an emotional need, just like the person in the first half, but has learned how to get their intellect to have control over that emotional need? And so they are holding back speech or restraining their lips, even though they'd like to say all this stuff, but they have control over that emotional need.
Right, they do have control.
Right.
Why would that make them wise, though? Where does the wisdom come in?
I would presume it's because they see the potential harm that the multiplicity of words will do.
All right. I'm wondering if there's some...
The verse, and so they're...
What's that?
They read the first half of the verse, so they're trying not to fall in that trap.
I'm wondering if it's also because a person who decides not to speak is because he prefers something else. In place of speech,
he prefers, when you're not speaking, what are you doing?
You're listening.
You're thinking. I mean, when you're not involved in the act of speech, that means you've considered. You've been involved in thought. So that involvement in thought means that you're not talking. When a person's thinking, he's not talking. So that's what he calls them wise, maybe, that if the person chose not to speak, it's true, everything you've all said. I'm just trying to get to see where the wisdom really comes from. And it could be because this person is engaged in thought by the fact that he's not speaking. Even Pirkei Avos says this, that the, one of the rabbis said he found nothing better than silence. Not because silence is not doing anything, because silence means you're letting the mind explore. You're allowing the mind what it needs. There's no interruptions. You're not involved in any action. The mind is completely immersed in thinking. And if that's who you are, then you must be a wise person. Because now you're exploring the world of ideas. So this person didn't speak. Why? He had something to say, but he had considerations. That means the fact that he's silent right now means he's thinking. So he's a maskil. He's a wise person. It's the very inactivity which means that he must be thinking. But it's inactivity when he had something to say. It's not a person who's at the beach just looking at the blue sky and his mind is just like wandering. That person also wasn't speaking, but you don't call that person wise. The person who's wise is the one who had something to say, but then a process went on where he was inactive. That must mean that he's thinking. That's the only process that can be going on. So it's indicative of the mind at work. That's what the person is holding back his speech, and that's why it's wisdom. What do you think?
That works, but I would question whether we can automatically jump from because he's not speaking, because he's thinking he's wise. Because a person could be not saying anything and thinking, but it seems like they could also be unwise.
Yeah.
All right, why don't we give it some thought?
Okay.
I hear you. I hear what you're saying.
But you know what? To your point,
yeah.
The whole second half says, he who restrains his lips, not just he who is silent. So, in this case, he's obviously got some things that he could say and maybe is driven to say, but he's holding back, which means a certain thoughtfulness that I think supports your point.
Right.
If it just said he who is silent is wise, then I could probably argue my point more strongly.
Mm-hmm.
And what about sifas of lips as opposed to speech? The beginning says, in the abundance of words, right, there will not cease to be sin. But one who holds back, one who restrains his lips is wise. It's not that he restrains his words, but he doesn't even make a sound. I mean, there's absolute silence. If you would have said, one who restrains his words, so then he spoke something. He's just restraining them. But here he wants to let you know the guy didn't say a thing.
Right. And I don't think we ever see a case where someone who holds back from speaking is considered to be a fool.
Right. All right, we'll give it some thought. Is there anything you want to take up for next week? Anything on your mind?
I don't have anything burning.
Well, we're coming into Sukkot.
All right, so we'll probably be doing some studying out here. Maybe we'll do is the Koheleth, of course, is what we read on Sukkot. So Ecclesiastes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's King Solomon's other big work.
Well, I'll tell you, first question I would throw out for consideration then is, why is that read on Sukkot? I'm not looking for an answer today, but...
Okay. All right, good question.
It seems like I don't immediately get the connection.
Well, it could say off the cuff that, like Rabbi Chait explained, that Passover is leaving the wrong ideas, meaning leaving Egypt. And Shavuos was at Sinai getting the right ideas. And Sukkot is living the right ideas, meaning you live in a temporary structure. You understand that you're dependent on God. You have a lot of ideas. We rave around the four species to show that all of our life, our food, our sustenance is from God. So it could be, since we're talking about expressing the right philosophy in life, so that's basically what Koheleth, what Ecclesiastes is all about, the search for the right life. That's what that book is about. All right, so maybe we'll look at that a bit, and so we'll do stuff on Sukkot and maybe Koheleth next Sunday.
That would be great.
All right, very good. That was a good discussion today. All right, so, and again, if there's any questions or anything, you know, comes up during the week, feel free to email or call me or whatever.
All right.
Thank you, Rabbi. Right. This is very interesting.
Okay, my pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Okay, well, so have yourself a good week, and I won't speak to you till after the holiday, so enjoy, and hopefully we won't get wet in the sukkah, but I'll give you a full report.
Okay.
Okay.
We're on for next Sunday?
Yeah, we'll be on for next Sunday.
Okay.
All right, very good.
Bye, Taylors. Bye, Rabbi. Thank you.
You're welcome. Take care.
Thanks, okay. Rabbi.
Okay, have a nice week.
Thanks, you too.
Okay.
Bye.
Okay, that ends today's session. We'll continue next week, same time, 11:15 Eastern Time. And until then, have a very good week and a happy Sukkot.